Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome to Gather Round. Tonight, we're talking gardening. And we have Mark Brown here, who's the chairman of the Carondelet Garden Urban Farm in St. Louis. And Joey and Holly Baird, you can find at www.thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. Hi, guys.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Hey. You guys are the ones, you know what's happening. Mark is doing a community garden, and Joey and Holly have, you have YouTube videos all over the place and your website. So would you all just give me a little bit of background, how you got interested in gardening?
Okay, I'll start. Joey here from the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. Grew up on a farm in southern Illinois and had always been involved in gardening, and it was just a way of life. You grew your own food, and what you couldn't grow, you bought at the store, and it's carried on throughout meeting Holly, and we've been able to grow a small garden and try and produce some of the food that we eat on a daily basis.
And I grew up in a household where we were in the city, but we still planted a small garden, and we also had a huge compost pile that we actually probably didn't need all that compost, but we had one, and it worked well for us. So.
Okay. And Mark, how did you get interested in this?
Well, I grew up a city boy who was forced to dabble in country affairs and, from time to time. And I think some of my upbringing, had a real influence on that, because both my parents were born before the war. So they grew up knowing the Victory Garden, and they come from a long line of farmers themselves. So I think that we were sort of a farm family that went city for a while, and then this boy has come back. But he technically hasn't left the city. That's basically how I got into it, really. And for the last 10 years, I've been heavily dabbling with urban agriculture and solving issues on growing in urban situations, and that's how I got involved.
I want to ask why your garden there in St. Louis is called a garden urban farm.
Because basically we started out as the Carondelet Garden. It was to put it nicely, it was a den of corruption, in a sense, to where there was all this drug traffic, and they had to tear this building down. And the city is just basically looking at this huge empty lot saying, now what are we going to do with this? And we turned it into a community garden that was really started off as a flower garden. But very quickly, probably because of some of my influence, but just the overall sentiment of the country, there seemed to be a lot of people coming in wanting to grow in the city. Some of these folks, especially in St. Louis, there seems to be a rise of these small homes with a concrete backyard for some reason. And they look at our community garden and our urban farms as their backyard. Now, how it got the name Urban Farms attached to it, because we quickly began to branch out off of that property, and we began to move into others. And right now, collectively, between a bunch of different satellite sites, we're in practically almost 12 acres right now.
Okay.
That's why it's called the urban farms.
Right. How much time do you think that you spend, say, a week? And I know that different parts of the season it's more or less, but how would you average out, Mark, how much time you spend with the community garden?
I couldn't even begin to guess that. I don't even keep a time card on it, to be honest. But there are days where I seem to be there all day. And because they're all local, I pass out, you know, I go through each site between the night. I also run a compost system for a couple of restaurants here in town. And often the kitchen scraps are chicken fodder for the next day.
Okay.
And so we have a variety of chicken houses that are on, you know, on these properties, and collaborative properties, let's just say, because we have a lot of urban farmers that are collaborators with us. And so we seem to be this growing collection of people who want to farm. Some of these people want to farm like us. We started out as wanting to eat what we grow. But then we quickly began to grow so much, we started giving it away to the poor.
Right. In fact, you just told me you have like an acre and a half that is just specifically for feeding the poor.
Actually, we have more than that in our collection of acreage, but that acre and a half that I spoke about is another collaborative venture with a real good fellow down here by the name of Dennis Potter.
Oh.
And we help him out as much as we can, basically bringing cardboard, coffee sacks. We're building a whole new floor. We're literally starting a farm on top of dead land.
I wanted to ask Holly and Joy a bit about that, because if somebody has just their own property at home and it's never been dug or anything, it's been lawn, is it a good thing to go ahead and do the cardboard in different mulch before you turn it? Or do you think if it's virgin ground, it doesn't need turning? I mean, it doesn't need a mulch? Or how does that work for now in the autumn?
Where we got our big garden at, Holly's mom said she was tired of cutting grass in the backyard and said, you know, do what we want with it. So we just went in with a shovel and just flipped it over, and it naturally composted the grass underneath the soil when we flipped it over. And we had no issue with it. Now, if you're going to start on your own property and you have an older house, I would recommend getting a soil test, because typically if you have a house that's more than 50 years old, there is a possibility that there was lead paint on that house at one time and could have gotten the soil. So you want to get that checked out before you start growing any edible items in your backyard, if that's the case.
Okay, if there is lead, what is there some amendments you can use, or are you just out of luck?
Go ahead.
Out of luck?
You're virtually out of luck. It depends on the situation. See, why we do the cardboard and mulch and, a whole new floor is because, unfortunately, in our area, we're forced to deal with, we don't find a lot of lead. That is primarily to the south in the county south of us, in the lead belt, what they call the lead belt. Here in St. Louis, it's clay and lots of rock. And the ground is practically worthless. So we put a whole new ground in. We bring in soil, we bring in everything,
sense.
And build up fresh. Yeah.
Now, I think Wisconsin probably has some pretty good soil.
Right.
Yeah.
They've got great
so.
Soil from what I've seen.
Yeah.
Right. It's just the cold winters that get you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's beautiful in the summertime. A lot of people do say, it's wintertime. Most of our crops are in, so we're done. And if they had viney things, they may pull the vines and throw them in a compost pile. But all of you know that it's just it's a seasonal change, but you can still keep doing things in the garden. And I want to ask Joy and Holly what they are going to grow this winter.
Well, we just started some radishes outside, and if we have to, we'll move them inside. But we fed those this past Sunday. What else did we start? We started some leaf lettuce.
Some bok choy and some trays that sit on the porch. So if it does get to the point where it gets extremely cold outside, below 35, we can bring them in and put them in our little greenhouse that sets next to the window so they can get adequate sunlight.
And the one thing we do year-round is we grow herbs in our kitchen window year-round. So that's one thing you can always grow year-round. As long as you have good sunlight, you can grow container herbs.
Yeah. Now, you would say that should be like south or west facing, I mean, here in the northern hemisphere, yeah.
Right, correct, yeah.
So the herbs need a lot of that, as far as I know. What about you down there, Mark? I know you're growing garlic, because I think you're going to have St. Louis the next
what they call Gilroy, California, for the garlic. Because
we're quickly building up that way. Like Rome, Gilroy wasn't built in a year.
Exactly.
But in a sense, they are the mother of all American garlic fests anyway. And so, you know, I mean, the accomplishments they have out there, and there's a few others across the country that, you know, they're in their own right. But we kind of worked on that problem. It's that a lot of people, a lot of backyard gardeners, as soon as they pulled up their tomato plants and their pepper plants, it's the end of the growing season for
them. Right, they were done, right? I mean,
and in reality, you can push the envelope depending on where you're at. Now, in our neck of the woods, unfortunately, because we had these sort of Death Star summers, this global warming winters, you know, we were harvesting cabbage in February.
Okay.
Literally, one of our lots is just purely for experiment. We try to push the envelopes with certain crops and attempt to see what comes out. And we were surprised at the fact that even the garlic was early. And as far as what we do, we have some favorite pepper plants that we dig up and bring inside every year. Fortunately, I have a back facing solarium, so I get, it's full sun, especially through all winter. Once the leaves are off, you know, some of the background trees, literally it gets full sun. And, we bring in peppers. A lot of people don't realize that, with adequate lighting, that you can extend your pepper.
Now, are those sweet peppers or hot peppers?
What was that?
Are they sweet peppers or hot peppers?
One of my favorites is this Italian red. I've got a 5-year old habanero bush. I got a couple of prairie fires that are just they're like shrubs now. this depends. Now for your average backyard gardener, I would say that if they had pulled up their tomatoes and peppers and they were looking at, you know, the stale ground. I would say, why not radishes? Why not lettuces? First of all, those are usually quick turnover crops that and turnips that the average homeowner could.
Oh, really? Turnips too, huh?
Oh yeah. You know, you're just about 40 days.
Joy and Holly said they just planted the lettuce, so that would be like leaf lettuce and different kinds of greens. So what's that take? Maybe 45 days or so.
Yeah, that was about 45 days.
Yeah. Okay. So that, and then radishes are a fast growing. Green onions, maybe.
You could get the greens. You won't have the bulbs, but you could push the envelope on those. Yeah.
Okay.
We have little green onion plantations and a variety of chives, and that with a lot of our what most Americans would call scallions. We never remove the bulb from the ground. We just leave them in the ground, and then they'll just grow a whole new shoot. Actually, that's one way for a common homeowner to extend the harvest is if they buy the scallions at the store. A common practice is to cut off the white root bulb end, and most people throw that away. They don't know that you can actually replant those and grow a whole new crop.
Do you need to plant them? I don't know, get the root system going before, get something on top before you plant them out, or?
They might benefit from anybody's homemade concoction. Lots of people swear by lots of, diverse things. I personally planted them just right in some nice, moist, nutrient-packed soil, and they've taken off. So.
Yeah. Well, okay, now, I bought the other day, just because I was going to ask you all, a bulb of garlic at the grocery store that was, it's really sprouting. I mean, like practically every little clove has a green from a half inch to maybe 3/4 of an inch. And I want to plant this out. So what would be my best things to do? How do I do
that? Mark, you want to handle that? Because you're a little more expert on the garlic.
Sure, no problem.
We are.
That's a broad question because I would have to ask you, what do you got going on now as far as space goes, planting space?
Plenty of space.
Well, just put it in some tilled soil. And garlic is actually forgiving. I mean, I've planted this stuff in some of the roughest city soils. And by rough, I mean, you know, heavy clay content. They seem to do well. A lot of people plant, you know, people have different spacings. We go by a pretty tight spacing, and we're every 6 inches and a foot across.
Mm, okay.
So a bulb every 6 inches, and then make your rows, you know, 1 foot.
How long does it take maybe for garlic, if you plant it now, for it to be edible?
Yeah, you're going to be harvesting. I'm trying to think. You're a little bit more north of us. You're probably going to be pulling yours out definitely in June. Ours came in real early this year, and ours wasn't in like, I think that it was the third week of May. And they'd already been in the ground too late. It was unbelievable.
Year was unusual. So I think it was way far north where it's Julian Holly too. This has just been strange. The climate change is really messing up. I know that USDA or whoever has the zoning thing, that's changed. So, you know, if you've been going by a certain zone, you may want to look at the new map. And then also, though, remember that every area has their own little microclimate. In your own yard, you've got microclimates, different ones.
Exactly.
Right. So what works, you know, 3 feet away or four might not. Like Mark went on talking about experimenting, that's the whole thing. And I've heard Jim and Holly say that before, too, that they're experimenting. That's what this is about. I wanted to give their website is www.thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and the YouTube videos are the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. And I think you can access everything from this website, can't you?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And they make tons of videos. They are on Akasha Temple Live every Thursday night. We see them everywhere. And Mark he's the chairman of the Grande Lake Garden Urban Farm in St. Louis, which has about 12 acres right now altogether. And they seem to keep gaining. And you told me that St. Louis is a garden city with 210 gardens in the city?
That's just aligned. That's just aligned with one group. That's 210 gardens out of that. The true total is unknown because I would say probably at least half are not part of that 210. Mm.
Nothing to do with people's personal gardens. I mean, we're not talking about that.
This isn't personal gardens. This is either either micro farms, where basically someone has turned their an extra lot they have into a food production area, or this is a community garden set in place by a Betterment Federation. Ours was aided along by the Carondelet Community, a Betterment Federation, and they, you know, saw the need for this garden, and we worked with Gateway Greening here in St. Louis. They basically maintain this 210 garden list. That's what we know of. But I know a lot more urban farmers that technically wouldn't be classified as a garden, but yet they have this micro farm. They're pushing the envelope and literally producing food on every square inch possible.
Well, now I know that you're all very aware of all the GMOs in our food, and this is one of the reasons why we really want people to be growing their own, because we've just found out that stores like Whole Foods, they've just admitted that a lot of their prepackaged goods and all has GMOs in it. And, you know, so you really, really have to be careful. And I know you use organic seeds. And I wonder, Joey and Holly, you have a seed company called Dollar Something that you do advertise for.
Right, yeah, dollarseed.com.
And all organic seeds, flowers, herbs, and vegetables, no GMOs. And it's for the average gardener, average backyard, really good seeds. We use them all the time, and we've had nothing but success with them.
Yeah, I'm going to try some of those. I use things from Baker's Creek, the heirloom seeds. They're a company in Mansfield, Missouri, and you can find them at www.rareseeds.com. They are taking a big lead in fighting the GMOs, and you know, a lot of these smaller companies have been bought out. Organic seed companies or heirloom seed companies have been bought out by Monsanto and that ilk. Just, you know, because they cave for whatever reason for the money, and you know, we cannot let, so we need to buy from these organic companies to keep them in business, and keep them from selling to these guys that will just ruin our food even more.
And while we're trying to do that, we should encourage, like these fine folks from Wisconsin are doing, and starting your own seed company. Save your GMO seed, your non-GMO seeds, and perpetuate them amongst your neighbors.
Yes, a lot of places have those seed exchanges, which sounds just great. I mean, it's, you know, everything that we do, even if it's for the benefit of us, it doesn't have to be sort of dour and, you know, all straight face. I mean, you can have fun. And harvest festivals, I think, are one of the best things, because there, again, you can take, like you said, your seeds, exchange them. You have the seed exchange table. You have this. You have that. You have all these knowledgeable people. It's a great thing. Yeah.
We call that a socialist seed swap. And we do that at our events. And Tuesday, this upcoming Tuesday, we're having a kids' scarecrow making workshop, and where we're going to have a hot soup bar and a hot chocolate bar right there in the garden, and the kids are going to be able to make these scarecrows out of sustainable items. Well, you know, a sustainable art, because basically these are all recycled and repurposed products. So
that's fun, and you know, it's good. We're doing this for the kids, so that, you know, the adults can have fun too. But as long as you know, bill it for the kids, it makes it okay for everybody to kind of get in on it. So, have any of you taken formal courses, or is this just been experiential? Have you done any kind of college courses, master garden courses, anything along those lines?
No, we haven't. We've just kind of learned from experience, and like you said, an experimental thing. And I'm sure if we took classes, that would actually help us be better gardeners. But also, there's some things that textbooks can't teach you.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, they're good for some foundations. And I know a lot of people who've done the master gardeners, and they really did. I mean, if they threw themselves into it, they got a lot of knowledge. But it is like anything else. When you're really, really into it, you're passionate about it, you're going to learn. I don't know, Joy and Holly, are you interacting live in Wisconsin with your neighbors gardening, or anybody? I know Holly's mom said, here, take the yard, do whatever. I'm sure that she likes what she gets out of it. That benefits more than just a sterile-looking expanse of grass.
Right. We do talk to the neighbors, as well as interact heavily on Facebook, Twitter, and we're going to be doing a demonstration talk at the Madison Expo Garden, the Garden Expo in Madison in February, on basically using what you already have in the garden, how to save money, and how to be fruitful with what you got.
Right. Yeah, that was something I wanted to ask all of you also. For, you know, people like yard art. I say that because I like yard art. I think everybody does. Or garden art, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have the funds to go out and buy the new stuff, and I don't want to, because I want to recycle, reuse the whole thing. So what would be some of your favorite things that may have outlived their usefulness in your home that you can use outside to maybe, you know, just make your garden more vertical or whatever?
An old dog kennel, the metal cage, you disassemble that and disinfect it with some vinegar, and you can use that as a great trellis. If you've got an old baby crib, the sides as well as that metal bottom grate can be used as trellis to grow any vine crop.
And then the fan grates.
Fan grates on the box fans. On the box fans, you cut them in half, and you can use them as decorative borders around whether flower beds or vegetables that critters like to nibble on, and keep the critters away until the plants get established. That's a great reusing item. You can recycle the fan and the motor and reuse the plastic grates.
And you could even reuse, you know, coffee tins or coffee containers, whatever you call them. If it's a plastic one, you can make it into like a scoop. If it's like one of those plastic ones that have
the square, the Maxwell House.
Yeah, I think it's Maxwell.
It's got the handle. You can cut the top off and actually use it as a scoop, whether you're feeding your chickens or digging compost out of the compost bin. That's another great item to reuse instead of recycle.
And you can even use a milk jug, you know, as a scoop, or just even, you know, to plant something in. You know, we've got, we find a lot of stuff on the side of the road, and we've got some herbs planted. Actually, somebody threw out these galvanized metal pots, and we put our herbs in there because it looks nice. And
I can see that. What about with the community farm, Mark? What kind of
All the aforementioned doghouses, when we get our hands on them, we turn those, we'll basically put a repurposed doghouse on stilts and turn that into a chicken house. And we'll give it away to any of the our poorer neighbors who, we live in a very, you know, it's a working class blue collar kind of town, and so these are, you know, salt of the earth people, and they're not adverse to growing chickens in their backyard, and that's something you can grow all winter long, chickens, if your community allows it. Under St. Louis law, we're allowed 4 chickens per household.
A lot of places are doing that now. If I had more fencing and this kind of thing, I think I'd do that. Not to eat them or eat their eggs or anything, but chickens are such great pets. And, I mean, they come in all colors and temperaments and all. So I'd have some chickens as pets. But, a lot of towns, though, are letting people have, like you said, up to 4. That seems to be the number. And no roosters.
To be honest with you, in the city, although the law says 4, many people I know who have chickens rarely have 4 or less. The key word in the law there, and it's in many communities who do allow backyard chickens, is 4 hens per household.
Some places don't want any roosters at all because they just think they're noisy.
I kind of like their sound.
I love their sound. there's one, I haven't heard it lately, but maybe I've been sleeping through, but it would start anywhere from 2 in the morning to 4:30 at the edge of town where I am, and, you know, he's saying hello to everybody, so, yeah, I like the way they sound. I think it's cool, but I can understand, if somebody's doing shift work or something, maybe, and they really need that sleep, they may not want to hear a rooster every morning early. I don't know. What about I don't know, if you have a lot of room, you can do more with the, footpaths and things with stones or something that you might gather or make or buy. But if you don't have that option, what do you think about just little paths? The dirt packed down with maybe straw on top or something like that? How would you do that?
Mark, you want to take that one and then we'll follow up on it?
I was hoping, I didn't hear the question clearly, so I'm going to have to ask you.
That's fine. For pathways, you can, if you have a lot of space, you can do pathways with, you know, just dirt and putting straw on top of it. or if you have a coffee house nearby that brings in a whole coffee ground, coffee beans in the burlap bags, you can lay those down as walkways. And that's a reusable, biodegradable item.
And you just have to ask them.
Right, right. If you know a farmer, feed sacks, but you want to be careful with the ink on the feed sacks. If they're just plain paper sacks, that would be fine. Now, one thing that we do is your floor lamps. They have that black piece of plastic with sand or a concrete mix in the bottom of it. When the lamp breaks or when we find them and they're no good, we'll disassemble it and take that black ring and place them in the garden as stepping stones to minimize compaction on the soil so we don't disturb the least amount of roots as possible when walking through the garden.
Another thing you can do, there's a lot of tutorials online for this, where you can make your own garden stones. Maybe not necessarily for walking on, but maybe, you know, for the look of it, is you can use plaster pears. And I know there's a lot of tutorials online for that, using plaster pears to make a walking a garden stone or a garden plaque or whatever they call them.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, it's just beautiful in its own. So you can do that.
We just use cardboard. Often we'll cover with a coffee sack. Some of the Bermuda grass I've noticed here in the city has a way of weaseling through some of the coffee sacks. So usually what we do is that we'll just lay down the cardboard. We'll lay coffee sacks down on top of those. The two of those in conjunction seem to harbor a fantastic future mycelium homeland. And really it's this sort of cooperative efforts between the two, your plants and this mycelium, that can really benefit your plants. So we realized that if you put in the coffee sack with the cardboard together, helped aid that, that community. But and then we'll just usually cover that stuff with your standard wood chips, which we get, we get truckloads of. So
now the wood chips, that's one of those things you need to remind people that you do get them from the woodcutters, but you, evidently, I've been told that they wouldn't let you have them if they came from diseased trees, but that is something they need to check on for sure.
When they're found down here, they sort of ex-nay those real quickly. Those don't enter the public stream, but the city of St. Louis, they're working with us, and they're fantastic, when it comes to getting varying compost tree parts. We'll usually get the wood chips when we know, it's sad to say, but sometimes we'll get some violent storms here, like we did just here the other night, yesterday, that will literally tear the trees, to shreds. And we know that in the parks, they're basically taking care of this 1, 2, 3. And so that's when we usually put in our order for wood chips, because we know that we'll get them by the, by the yardage. We'll get in 5, 6, 7 truckloads, whatever we need, so.
Yeah. So, well, there, Mark, with the urban farm, you have some type of a building at the main site where you keep all the equipment. How does that work?
Right now we have just the the sheds and whatever storage buildings we have. Come later on this fall, working with another not-for-profit group here in St. Louis, we're going to build a greenhouse out of recycled materials, and we've already started to amass these. We actually have all the glass. We have all the material. We're just waiting for the end of the growing season so we could scrape one of our sites clean. We're going to have the bulldozer come through. They're going to take out all our berms, we worked on that with horse manure and all these, all this compost from the restaurants and so it's good stuff. So anyway, we're going to remove that and take that off to another site. And on that site, we're basically going to build our greenhouse.
Right.
But it's going to be an aquaponics system, because we're actually going to have a pond underneath the greenhouse itself. We'll raise tilapia and prawn. And, of course, crappie is a great eating fish, and I love it. I'm sorry if we had any fisk-loving friends, but I do love my fish.
Mm-hmm. But what about because you've got wheelbarrows, you've got shovels, hoes, all these things. So they're kept in a shed for weather purposes, but I mean, I'm just wanting to know the nitty gritty about the urban farm. Does everybody have a key to the shed? Or is the shed not locked?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Huh. Oh yeah, without a doubt. And then we also have a mother source that we can always tap into. But I pretty much keep a full stock of equipment there for.
Okay.
And we'll have large volunteer groups come out. We'll have 50, 60, 70 people at a time.
Right.
In later on in October, we're about to have, I believe, it's 200 people.
Who's doing some of this gardening with you, if they just want to go someday and there's nobody else there, they can get in to the tool.
They're just given the combinations, so, and they're told where the key is.
Okay.
But
yeah.
For the most part, all the collaborative farmers, we're all on a regular schedule that just sort of pop like synergy. It just happened. And, like I said, we all have keys. And why I mentioned the large groups is that sometimes we get hit with these volunteer groups that are very large, and it's sometimes a struggle to make sure you have enough equipment, because you're basically looking at, 7-8
people. You see that? Yeah.
You need about 30 shovels. So there's that in itself is a job just to keep up with that. So,
sure. Well,
but we love them though because there's some of the mass amounts of work that we've done and accomplished at certain times has been due to them. Especially in the fall groups, we love them because one of our mother sites right now currently is the Carondelet Community Garden located at 5810 Michigan. And we'll just have them come through, and we have an extensive flower collection there, and I mean extensive. And there's always weeding that needs to be done. So,
I wanted to ask Roy and Holly too. Their own garden. How much, would you say percentage wise is flowers or floral? And because I know we can eat a lot of flowers, put them in salads and this and that. Like you said, you have your herbs inside. Even if you have them outside, you have them inside all year round, too. But what about, do you grow very many flowers, or are you sticking pretty much with real edibles?
We grow some flowers. We grow flowers just
to attract the bees.
To attract the bees. And then we also grow sunflowers.
Which basically
is pretty.
Pretty, yeah. And the birds kind of got a hold of them, which we would save them for the seeds, but the birds ate them, so that's fine. But I think with a 1,700 square foot garden, I think we had about 20 square foot of just flowers just to bring the pollinators in and also to help them build their hives for the cold winter to come as well.
Okay. And you had that. It was like one location. It wasn't scattered throughout or on the edges or sides or anything?
No, it was in the center of the garden.
Mm. Oh, okay, cool.
We do put marigolds around the edges to deter the rabbits, but with the drought and the heat and stuff, we dealt with a lot more pests than normal this summer. So, and I think that's why the birds got to our sunflowers before.
But we're okay with
that. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we need to share with the other creatures, not just other humans, that's true. But I don't know. Mark, what about, are you guys growing very many flowers, or is it pretty strictly?
Well, we have a year-round flower collection. Well, not year-round, but it comes pretty close to it, where we have pushed the envelope on both sides, and we have very, very happy bees.
Do you have any hives? Or are you doing any hives?
Oh, yeah.
You are. Yeah.
Oh yeah. We basically have collaborative. I believe the term is apiarist, beekeepers.
Oh.
And they basically, they run that show, and they've got fabulous bees. These guys are super content, I've come close enough to pet them on occasion. That's how nice they are. On another note, you mentioned about rabbits. Growing up in Chicago, as a kid, I was used to seeing the city rat problem. And there were, rats everywhere. down here in St. Louis, I don't see rats as much, but what has filled that niche is these cottontail rabbits. And they are, like, everywhere. But we have this old maple tree out, that's one of our adjacent neighbors. It's their tree. And a hawk has taken up residence there. And then also we seem to have the width of the bars on our fence. We have one of these vertical Gothic style fences. Seem to be wide enough that they can pass through.
Oh, sure.
And the feral cats will often make their passes through the garden. And when it comes bunny season, unfortunately, I hope we don't have any people who are offended by this, but they're usually cut out of the ecosystem real quick. And then there's this old wives' tale about rabbits not liking garlic. I don't know if there's any truth to this, but I do know that, like, when we dig up some of our soil later on here this fall to plant some of, you know, radishes and lettuces and whatnot, we can smell the stink of the garlic, you know, because some of these soils have had garlic growing in them for 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
We usually rotate, you know, we'll rotate after the third year and move it to, another place, but for the most part, we grow in our beds pretty much year-round, because when we're not growing produce, we try to grow garlic. Or we grow things that can, you know, certain kales can be extended into the colder periods, at least down here.
Heard.
So.
Yeah. I heard the kale will get sweeter after the first frost.
That holds true with Brussels sprouts, too.
Ah, okay. Okay, so from the cruciferous family, and just like you said, then you were harvesting cabbages. February. I mean, all of that stuff, really, it can stand some of the cold. I don't know if it can stand as cold as Joy and Holly have it.
We still have our kale on the ground.
Yeah, kale will stand temperatures down to 20 degrees. It won't grow, but it's not going to die on you. So you could actually leave it out there until it gets to that average temperature. Then you want to bring it in and make kale chips or process it however you feel the need to.
Or just eat it.
Or just eat it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm one of those latecomers to kale chips, and I fell in love.
Everybody does.
We recently found that you can do the same thing with Swiss chard leaves as well, but you have to eat them a little more quickly than they don't store as long-term as the kale chips do.
Ah, okay. Yeah, because chard is softer to begin with.
Correct.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah, the I have tried, I have been creative with my kale chips. From, you know, I get mustard oil at the indie pack stores, and I sprinkle them with mustard oil and put, like, mustard seeds with them before the oven. I've done za'atar, which is a combination of spices from Palestine. I've done, garam masala. I've tried everything with my kale chips because it's all so good. They really, you know, popcorn, I used to think was a food group, but it isn't now. It's been replaced for me, so it works. I know that, Joey, earlier you had a video out showing double digging, and I wanted to ask, now, if you get a very nice culture of species going in your soil, and you've put out a lot of cardboard, you've got a good worm community going, do you really want to, I mean, how much do you want to dig up for the next year's growing?
Typically, if the soil is already loose and looming, you've got a good stand of worms in it, you don't need to double dig. The only time you really need to double dig is if that top layer of soil is very dense. If you've got a lot of clay in your soil, you can amend it with good compost, and that'll also bring the worms closer to the top of the ground. But, yeah, only double dig whenever it is absolutely necessary and the soil is very dense and compacted. And we did that with about a 50-square-foot area of our garden, and we had the best onions that we've ever grown before.
Right.
We had some that were nearly baseball size, and beets. Beets were incredible as well because I contributed to that double digging. The beets roots were almost 9 inches long.
Wow.
Because they were allowed to penetrate downward because of the double digging.
Right. What about that, Mark? Have you guys been double digging, or do you use shovels, or do you bring in a tractor?
Well, that's actually something we're going to look forward to dabbling in the future here, because we've realized that although with a 10-acre site, your regular commercial farm equipment that, you know, we always collaborate with our neighbors, whether we're in the city or whether we're in the country. So with that aspect, it's just a commercial farm vehicle. And, you know, and they're very, you know, helpful in that with us. But when it comes to our city lots, we think we're going to get into this ATV run system, where basically they have a series of micro farm equipment that scale down to be run off an ATV.
Okay.
And we think we may, you know, get into that, as well as probably many other urban farmers, because we're not the only, you know, ones who are using it and eyeballing it. But it all depends. It depends on what we're growing and what we're doing. But yeah, just like it was said by Joey there, it's amending the soil is fantastic. At any chance you get, we get like 8 to 10 year old horsemen, and we're off of a horse farm that's been piloted up in a monster mountain, and they'll carve it off with a front loader and dump it right in the back of our trucks. It's great. Oh yeah, and we just, you know, drive on home with it. But yeah, that stuff is just fantastic, because you want to mend the soil. If you're a local urban farmer, get in bed with your, well, literally, not literally, but get in bed with your local cafe houses and your coffee producers, because you can take advantage of their coffee grounds, which is another black gold to us. We love that, and we collect it as much as we can. All the restaurants that compost for us separate that out and put that in one, you know, one barrel
your
itself.
Coffee grounds are separate, yeah.
And that's black gold. That's that's just fabulous stuff for a garden.
Well, now go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
we do that also. We contact
Starbucks.
And well, Starbucks they have to. They're required by their whatever
corporate
office
yeah.
that no matter what they're supposed to save the grounds for you. But there's a local coffee shop that that I support locally. And they just ask that we bring in a bucket, and then once the bucket's full, they just give us a call and we pick it up. So,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's excellent, because you're also by doing that, you're making people in these establishments aware, and
right.
you know, just in a very subtle way. And I love that.
The easiest thing to do is ask, and the worst thing can happen is they say no.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, they're not going to hit you or anything. So. Yeah, well, hopefully. Anyway. I read that some people say after you build, now this was like building on top of the, just say a corner of your yard, you start putting the cardboard and compost, dirt, maybe the horse manure, whatever, and you keep layering it. They call it like lasagna bed.
Yep.
And then after that, though, I mean, you don't, that's something that you don't go around digging, or turning over with any kind of equipment. You just seem to maybe hoe or shovel the depth you need, whatever, and plant.
Eventually you end up turning the ground, and I think that, it's just a, you know, it's a soil builder is what it is, and the lines between the layers will quickly begin to blur.
Yeah.
As these layers begin to meld into one another. Although it is lasagna, and you're constantly adding new stuff every year.
Well, that's it. So you keep adding to the layers. And
yep.
Yeah. Okay. And usually, though, that is like a bed, maybe with like wooden constraints or something. Do you, any of you use actual beds? As far as, with some kind of, you know, bricks or wood or something, separating it?
At our community garden, like I said, it was started out as a flower garden, really, with the people who dabbled in fruit and vegetables. But I don't know. I think we've got 16 beds there of all sizes, anywhere from 4 by 4 by 10s all the way up to like your big 20 by 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I like that as a community garden model because every bed represents a house, and all these houses together, clustered together, represent the community, and all the green space around this represents the world. And there's that, this sort of a love to be found there with that. Having said that, when we left the community garden and actually started practicing urban farming, that's where our whole idea of those raised beds and that aspect didn't really work out for us, because we realized that was for gardeners and we were farmers. And so we began to look and think as farmers would. And now you're looking at rows here, and that's where it's. And, some of our land is good to where we can literally put in farm rows like your stereotype farmer does.
Mm-hmm.
But some of our land is on the poorer side, like I said, lots of clay. So we build up these massive berms, these huge raised mounds that are cigar, they're kind of cigar-shaped, I guess, would be, a way to describe it. And we just lay those out in farm rows. And that's what
So you're doing the berms. Okay. Joy and Holly, are you doing beds or berms or...
Oh, we've got one small raised bed behind the garage, and that's basically just for greens, lettuces, and we do try to grow some radish in. And it's only 1 foot by 10 foot because we had the space to experiment with more, to grow more produce. Another way you can extend, or if you live in an apartment or don't have access to a ground garden, dresser drawer, solid wood dresser drawer, not the particle or board or the ones that are glued together. Drill a couple holes in the bottom, small holes, and it works great as a small raised bed as well, whether you're on your patio or picnic table or condo or whatever. You can also grow some food in that as well.
And if they're a little busted up, you can always, take a couple nails and kind of give them a little cheap fixing.
Right. They're only going to last 1 season.
Right. And we see them on the side of the road all the time. So
right. That's a good point. You said it should be real wood, not particle board.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to address, I saw a beautiful picture of tires. They were painted primary colors, and there were like 7 or 8 of them piled in this, nice design, and they were all growing flowers, which is it's a thing to grow in tires because you don't want to grow food in tires, as I understand. And even though these people were growing flowers, I hope that they weren't flowers they were going to eat. Because evidently, the tires will reach, and they'll do that for a long time. So while it's pretty, it should just be the flowers that you don't eat.
Correct.
But it does look nice in your yard. It's too bad that we have so many things available that we have to really check on, too. But like you've talked about, I love that idea of the used dog kennel. And then, like, dog houses, big ones for chickens, and all of those things. So any kind of metal that you can manage to stand up, you can grow things vertical on.
On some of the bad land that I told you about, we began to use, now when we get coffee sacks, most of your average person would get that from, like Joey mentioned, at your little... local coffee grinder, and we have a lot of startups across the country, and it's fabulous. I love to see that, the small business. But I go to the main distributors, and I'll pick up coffee sacks by the hundreds or the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And we stand those up, we fill those up, and we grow potatoes and sweet potatoes in them.
Okay.
And literally, we call it the no-till potato, because after the sack's been sitting out there, all year, the bottom literally rots out. And the burlap tube, in a sense, is just holding all this soil mixture. Because you mound up for potatoes, you're just constantly adding stuff in there. You're lasagnaing this sort of potato plant, and you're creating all this, you know, all this fabulous tuber action going on in there. But then when it comes time to harvest, it is fabulous. It's because you just pull up on the tube, and all the dirt and potatoes spill out right on the floor, and you've done two great things. Is, first of all, you get to, like, bend down, and without picking up a shovel, you get to pick up all this, you know, it feels like free produce.
That's got to be fun. I mean, just pull
out the spirit. Oh, it is. Because you brought, in the instance of our lot issue, because you brought these bags in on poor ground, you've now imported soil to this, you know, to this poor location.
Win-win-win. It is. So we've only got a few minutes left. Give us some advice now for fall that we can do at home.
Mark, you want to go first on that?
It depends on how adventurous you are. For some of the active urban farmers, it never ends. You could still grow crops. You could still push your envelope if your climate allows it. If you're in the city, you're going to be able to take advantage of the microclimate there, because you're going to get the island effect, and you're going to get this residual temperature that the surrounding areas around you aren't going to benefit from. But now's the time, if your garden is done, and I would be bringing in food for your garden, and you're going to want to bring in compost and new soil, and definitely build up. And do your research. Now's a great time, especially if you're not the time you would normally be done pulling weeds. You could be online researching things, you'll find that gardening and farming is always a learning endeavor. There is no one true expert, so there's always room to learn and always room to grow. No pun intended. Again, that depends on the adventurous nature of the person who is being asked this question, because it depends on your will. If you've got some things you can extend with hoop houses. Some things you can extend. It depends. You can make these little mini hoop houses. Out of just some gauge wire and some 6 mil plastic you picked up at your local Lowe's, Home Depot, fill in the blank. They're across the country, if you're like us, we pay a little bit more and we get them from our mom and pop hardware stores because we like to shop
exactly.
Local.
Exactly. If you can, please shop your local businesses.
You could be doing hoop houses. Now, depending on gardens go, as far as flowers, you're going to be looking at digging some bulbs up real soon here. Now's the time to clean out those daylily beds and those overgrown iris beds.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mark. What about you, Joy, Holly?
Getting towards the end of the season. Go to your local organic seed company, whether online or at your local garden center. Buy organic seeds. A lot of them are on sale now. Plan ahead for next year. Keep it simple. Only grow what you like to eat, but experiment on one or two varieties of plants you haven't grown yet to try something new in the garden. And ask, now's the time to ask your neighbors, hey, I saw you, what type of things did you grow in your garden? Did you like them? How did they work out for you? Would you recommend me growing them? So always be thinking ahead.
Also, an idea for the hoop house, which we actually did a show on, was, what would we use? It was a vacuum hose?
Yeah, vacuum hose is in an archway and used a
old
bed sheet. It was more of a frost cloth, but yeah, it's the same concept.
Okay, our time is up, guys. Thank you so much, Joy and Holly. www.thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. And Mark Brown on Facebook at Carondelet, that's Carondelet, Garden Urban Farm. And I look forward to having you all back.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for 30 Minutes with Michael Staple.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of 30 Minutes. I'm your host, Michael Staples, and just as a quick note, all of these shows are pre-recorded. This evening, my guest is Fred Goodnight. Fred Goodnight is a drummer, a percussionist, a teacher, and an elder member of a unique group out of Bath, New York called the Peace Weavers. Fred, welcome to 30 Minutes.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael, for having me.
You're welcome. So, Fred, why don't we start off by telling our listeners who or what are the Peace Weavers?
Great question. I first got introduced to the Peace Weavers about 13 years ago, and obviously the brochure and the mail, and it sounded like something that I had been doing at another retreat center, but this was much closer to where I lived and a lot less expensive. And something about the name Peace Weavers that just really resonated with me, and I think I like the idea of weaving peace. You know, I think of our country as a fabric of all different tribes and different races and, you know, different ethnic backgrounds, and we can weave a common thread of peace through all of that, you know. So I just thought that was just a great idea. So the Peace Weavers, they've been at this for about 19 years now, and they started out as a small group, and then actually there still are a small group, about six people who actually run the show. The six people are husbands and wives, and they do year-round activities there, some of which is organic farming, which they sell the produce to the local supermarkets. They have a healing and fasting retreat. They have a building colloquium where they build structures out of natural materials that are actually gotten from the land. And then during August, when I go up, it's called Family Gathering, and it's where the children are present. People bring their children, and they have full range of most beautiful 250 acres that you can imagine. And on that 250 acres is a 5-acre spring fed lake in which the children can go swim under the supervision of, you know, some adults. And it's just a wonderful retreat to get away from the hustle and bustle of everyday life.
Absolutely. It sounds like an amazing experience. As I was reading a little bit about what the Peace Weavers do, they made a mention of something known as the Talking Stick Circle. What is that?
Yeah. That came about when the Peace Weavers were doing like a caravan event, going out to some of the reservations out far west. And in that part of the country, there's a lot of huge redwood trees. And this one redwood tree had gotten hit by lightning, and one of the branches fell down. So they retrieved a small branch from that tree, and they used that stick to pass around in a circle. When people gather, you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I had a beat there.
That's okay.
People gather around in a circle, and they share whatever they want to share. And there's two components to this that makes it a really powerful event. And first is listening, just listening respectfully to what another person has to say. And the person who has the stick is the only person that speaks. So when they're finished speaking, then they pass the stick on to the person beside them, either to the left or to the right, depending on which direction you go. So, you know, it's a little bit different than normal conversation where a person's talking and your buddy has something you want to say. But here, you know, it's the deepest respect for the person who has the stick. And a lot of times it's a very healing thing because people feel comfortable enough to share, you know, some really deep feelings about any number of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Amazing. So what is the importance of humor or laughter in the Peace Weavers?
wife had some terminal illness, and he would go to visit her, and he would tell jokes and make her laugh, and the doctors had given her a short time to live, and just through this laughter exercises, she was able to live much, much longer just by, you know, laughing and feeling good about, you know, whatever the topic of the conversation was.
Absolutely. I personally think laughter is probably about the best medicine out there. Now, the Peace Weavers talk a lot about building a sustainable community. What does it mean to live in a sustainable community?
Well, up there, again, like I mentioned earlier, we have 250 acres, and each year that I go up, more and more of that acreage is put into produce. So the Peace Weavers, in terms of living off the grid, so to speak, they're pretty much able to do that. They have their own heating source. There's like a small building outside of the main building. And the way this works is there's plastic pipes that run from that little building all throughout the main, what we call the longhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're able to heat the longhouse, which is a pretty good sized structure, from just burning logs that heat the water, and the water's pumped through the plastic hoses that go all through the rafters of the building. So there's no utility bill in terms of, you know, heating. And if you know anything about upstate New York, you have to use heat probably from the end of August to late spring.
Oh, my. Yeah. A long heating season.
I was there in August, second week of August, and the nights were very cool, and the mornings were very cool.
Oh, wow.
And so the produce, beautiful, beautiful produce is grown there on the land. And there's so much of it, they made an arrangement with a local supermarket called Wegmans. And Wegmans is the Mercedes of supermarkets.
Oh, really?
It's just unbelievable. I mean, if you go to a Wegmans supermarket, boy, that's quite an experience. So they sell wheatgrass and, you know, freshly grown greens and, you know, a lot of produce that they grow on the land to local supermarkets. And then also there's like a co-op where people invest an initial sum of money, and then once the produce, you know, is ready for harvest, they come over and they're welcome to get as much as they like and use it, you know, for their needs.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've been up there at different events. I've been up there when we harvest, you know, different, I think the year I went to harvest, event was we harvested gangs and gangs of potatoes. You know, you have to pick them up, wash them off, and then dry them. And it's just a nice event. You know, you're growing something without herbicides and pesticides, and it's, you know, very wholesome and nutritional.
Absolutely. I'm told that the Peace Weavers promote a vegan diet. Can you say anything to why they feel that the vegan diet is perhaps the most sustainable?
Yeah, a little bit I can share. First of all, let me speak about dairy. There's a doctor by the name of Colin Campbell who's did an exhaustive study about dairy and the effects of it. His book is widely available, and they showed how there was a situation, one of the wars, where the invading military confiscated all the cows for their own needs and for their own uses. So they got the milk and the meat
incredible. And I guess even during the recent Isaac storm, I guess there was another part of New Orleans that actually got hit really bad again. They had a lot of flooding and stuff. So who knows? Maybe the Peace Weavers will be down to visit them in the near future.
Well, we actually do go down. The times that I just mentioned is when we bring them up to New York. But
I see.
There's an organization called Love Knows No Bounds, and we take, furnishings and mattresses and whatever they need, we take it down there to them. And then there's a group of builders, and we actually help them rebuild their homes. So, we're involved with that as well.
When you go down to, like, say, New Orleans and so forth, is that what is as known as the Peace and Healing Caravans, or is that something different?
Yeah, that's a part of it.
Okay.
But primarily the Peace and Healing Caravans had to do with going out to the reservations. That's one of the reasons how the Peace Weavers got their momentum early on, going to the Peace and Healing Caravans with out on the reservations, and some of the conditions on the reservations are just unbelievable. But Love Knows No Bounds, that's not directly connected with that. That's just a separate organization. And some of the people that are in that Love Knows No Bounds organization are also Peace Weavers as well.
When you say that they went out to do work on reservations, you're talking Indian reservations, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And is there some kind of a connection between the Peace Weavers and various Native American tribes?
Not necessarily, no. They're just, they sort of pick out, they know some people on the res, and they stay in contact with them, and when time and money allows, they'll just take a caravan out there and, help those people with different things they're struggling with.
I see. Who are the elders of the Peace Weavers, and how does one become an elder of the Peace Weavers?
Just being able to survive to a ripe old age like myself. there's about four or five people, including myself. I'm 75, so that kind of puts me in a group of elders in any situation. I remember when my mom, when I was probably like 9, and I remember my mom was like, in her late 20s, and I thought, geez, that's old.
You're old.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay, Fred. I know you very well, and your 75 is most other men's 45.
Oh, I just keep plugging away.
Let's see. Now, you are also a very accomplished drummer, and you teach drumming in many various situations. I've learned drumming from you. How is drumming used to build community?
In a number of ways. First of all, what I like about drumming is accessible. Anybody can, even if you don't have a drum, you can play on a tabletop. Matter of fact, speaking of that, when I lived in Ohio, I had an all-women's drum group, and only one of the women knew how to play. The other 29 did not know how to play and didn't have drums, and we actually worked out the rhythms on the tabletop. So, rhythm is just that accessible, and it has a lot of benefits if a person will allow that to happen with themselves. It's certainly a stress reliever, and it doesn't have to be anything intricate for us to rhythm. It could just be a steady pulse about 180 beats per minute, and if you do that for about 15 minutes,
what are the special events that take place throughout the year with the Peace Weavers group?
Yeah, first of all, there's a New Year's retreat, and I've done that. And one of the things that's neat about the New Year's retreat that I thought was, it felt really nice for me, we do an Indian sweat lodge. And so New Year's Eve, we went out and we did sweat lodge. And after sweat lodge, because you're in there with just, you know, your underwear, and it's very, very, very hot. Well, New Year's Eve, you know, there's 8 inches of snow on the ground. So you have to come out of there, and you want to get dressed really quickly, but you're still sweating, you know. So one of the things that I find was so important to me is they asked me to speak something. And so I was, my words, whatever they were at the time, were the first words spoken that year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I thought, wow, you know, what a nice thing to happen, you know, that my words would be the first words spoken that year.
What did you say?
Oh, I don't remember. Hopefully it was something memorable.
That's right.
It was encouraging. Always it was going to be encouraging, you know. So we have the New Year's retreat, we'll be doing sweat lodge, and most of those events are indoors because it gets very, very cold up there. And then we have the planting, where we plant, you know, the crops, and people gather together. We have a couple big tractors, and we plant. And then there's a healing and fasting retreat, where you fast the whole time. The only thing you take for nutrition is just some bouillon. And I thought, I'll never make it because I have to have some food, you know. And surprisingly, you know, I did quite well with it. You know, I didn't miss, you know, eating a lot of solid food, just bouillon.
Mm-hmm.
And the bouillon was very, very healthy because they had this big, big pot and a bunch of celery, a lot of greens and stuff go in there. They take their greens out of there, and the only thing left is the bouillon from the veggies. And it's very nutritious. So a healing and fasting retreat, then there's a kids camp with all, it's all centered around the kids come and they can do different events. And then there's the, let's see, the summer, building colloquium, where we built some structures on the land and all the materials are gathered from the land. The wood, the clay, the straw, all gathered right there from the land.
So nothing is like bought at Home Depot or Lowe's.
No, not at all. Not at all. It all has to do with that whole idea of sustainability. So we have four or five structures that we've built, you know, out of all natural materials.
Mm-hmm.
And the one is like a round building. And so we have builders come. There's some builders that come from Arizona, another guy, and I think you can look out of there because the weather's always been mild.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happens before or after, but I get in there and get out. Before it gets nasty. I've been lucky in that regard. So that's a nice event. And then next year it starts all over again.
Oh, wow. Now, are there people that actually live on the Peace Weavers property, or do people just support it and, like, you know, live elsewhere, do their jobs, and then just come back for the various festivals?
Well, there's about six people or seven people who are actually there all the time.
Okay.
You know, Greg Lynn Weaver, who is the spiritual leader, if you will, and then his wife, Stephanie, takes care of all the food items. And there's a guy named Kobe and his wife, Beth. And Beth takes care of a lot of the children's activities. And Kobe takes care of a lot of the farming. He's very knowledgeable about, you know, farming. And then there's Willow. She takes care of a lot of logistics, planning, and, you know, all the communications. And then her husband, Al, he's able to step in and do just about anything. And then there's another guy, Kevin, who also steps in and does, you know, whatever. So those, that's the core group. And they're there all the time. And then there's another woman named Wendy, and she has a connection with the Wegmans supermarket. They're all over that area, as far down as Virginia. So, you know, it's nice to have that access to that whole bunch of supermarkets. So Wendy works at Wegmans, and she's been able to get some produce into their stores.
All right, guys. Well, listen, I apologize, but we are just about out of time. It goes by really fast. So maybe I can have you on again in the future to talk more about what some of the things that the Peace Weavers are doing.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Just let me know, and I'd be very happy to.
Okay, great. Well, for now, Fred, I just want to thank you for coming on the show and for a great 30 minutes, and to ask our listeners to join me again next week for another show with another individual and another story to share. Thanks,
thanks so
much, everyone, and have a great night.